This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. How good are American roads and bridges? Not very good at all. The American Society of Civil Engineers has given U.S. roads a D and bridges a C+. Whether it's a cracked sidewalk or a collapsed bridge, author Henry Petrosky says it is time to change how we think about infrastructure. His new book is called The Road Taken: The History and Future of America's Infrastructure. Henry Petrosky reads at the Regulator Bookshop tomorrow at 7 o'clock, and he is back with us on The State of Things. Welcome back, Henry. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here again.
We referenced the grades given to roads and bridges by the American Society of Civil Engineers. How would you rate and critique our country's infrastructure right now, you personally?
I would rate it as mixed. The American Society of Civil Engineers is an average grade that they give. But, you know, if I drive up one of the interstates from North Carolina up into Virginia, it depends. In North Carolina, the roads are good up there. Into Virginia, they're getting pretty poor. Virginia will fix them, and then they'll be better. And it goes back and forth like that. Roads need constant repair, constant maintenance, constant renewal. So depending on when you drive on them, when you speak about them, they are either good or poor. Overall, they're mediocre.
Has it always been this way? I mean, we parachute in, we say, what's our grade now? And I'd be a little shocked, I was, to find out that our roads have a D. But maybe they're always kind of averaging around a D, given the fact that they always need to be repaired.
Well, some of them do, but the ones that are recently repaired would get B or an A.
But what about that average? I mean, if I say the American Society of Civil Engineers rates U.S. roads a D, has that always been the case? I mean, has that average always been down around a D?
No. When the interstates were new, for example, back in the 50s and the 60s, when they were building them the first time, probably most of them would have gotten A's compared to what had come before. A century ago, probably the infrastructure of the U.S. roads would have gotten an F. It was so poor. So it's very, very time dependent.
A big example of how dangerous our roads and bridges are now, I guess, is when we can go back to that bridge collapse in Minneapolis in 2007. Remind us what happened there.
Well, Interstate 35 splits into W and E, west and east, to go through Minneapolis and St. Paul separately. And the one through Minneapolis, there's a bridge over the Mississippi River, and suddenly, during rush hour, I believe it was August 1st, 2007, the bridge collapsed under all the traffic. And it was a disaster. Took everybody by surprise, killed about a dozen or more people, injured a lot more. And it was a real wake-up call. It was a wake-up call because the bridge that collapsed had actually been inspected every year or so, as is required by the Federal Highway Administration. So this kind of thing should have been anticipated, that this bridge was weak, should have been closed or fixed. The fact that it wasn't highlighted some poor practices. Inspectors were not as alert or as vigilant as they should have been.
So this points to some human error, and we can expect any amount of that. And of course, the more roads and bridges we have, I guess we can, you know, we can expect more of that to happen. And I guess the question is, when we talk about the need to repair or the need to get busy and be more vigilant, which we are we talking about? Because there are states and federal, it seems to me, control over this. Where's the oversight, and where do we start putting on the pressure?
Well, it's complicated because, you know, whoever pays has pretty much the control, and the federal government has some control because it has some of the money. About 25% of all the money that goes into roads and bridges comes from the federal government. The federal government, however, can't build roads or own roads. It's not authorized by the Constitution to do that. So there is what's called a highway trust fund, and every time we buy a gallon of gas, we pay a good number of pennies in taxes. The federal government collects 18.4 cents per gallon, in fact, and that goes into a highway trust fund from which the federal government would dole out grants to the states. The states have to apply for that money, And it's through that process the federal government can exercise some control, some uniformity, which I think is good because it's nice when we drive from state to state that the yellow line is on the left, the white line is on the right, the traffic lights are in the same order, red, yellow, green, and so forth and so on. So federal oversight in this case, I think, is a good thing. However, we're having problems because that trust fund is running out of money. The 18.4 cents per gallon tax has been at that level since 1993. Hmm. And in the meantime, we've had a little bit of inflation. We've been spending more on roads and bridges because they've needed more work. But interestingly, there is also a sort of a counterintuitive factor here, and that is that we're not using as much gasoline, and therefore we're not paying as much tax, so the revenue into that fund is low. And this is one of those unintended consequences. The government has promoted hybrid cars, electric cars. Well, electric cars don't use gas at all. Hybrid cars use very little gas. Fuel-efficient cars use less gas than would have been projected, let's say, 15, 20 years ago. So for all these factors come together, and we just simply don't have enough money to do what needs to be done.
So what do we do? I mean, one of the things that, we certainly do is promote more rapid transit, right, and get some of these cars off the road. That would help, wouldn't it?
Well, that's one way, of course, would be to do that. But in this country, that would mean long-range transportation, say between cities, intercity travel. Generally, that would mean railroads, and basically, our railroads are in terrible shape. Amtrak is an embarrassment compared to Japan, China, France, Germany, you name it.
Any other developed, industrialized,
exactly,
modern, sophisticated,
exactly, you know,
country. You know.
And I don't know that we would have enough money in the foreseeable future to catch up without some drastic changes in the way we approach mass transit.
So how does this inadequate infrastructure that we have now affect our economy today?
Well, it affects it terribly. For example, one of the reasons that the American Society of Civil Engineers rates our roads and bridges so low is that they take into account congestion. And if a road is very congested, that means that people using it, automobiles, trucks, aren't going anywhere. They're stopped in traffic. The goods aren't being delivered, so it costs time, costs fuel because they're idling. And it's not good for the environment, not good for the economy. The driver has to be paid, usually by the hour. It's unproductive work if it's in congestion. And for all these reasons, the economy is just not able to perform at the rate that it would normally perform at. And if we're trying to attract a new factory, let's say, in an area, and we don't have good roads if they're congested, that is not going to be something that will that kind of business will not come to that area, and that will certainly affect the area.
Isn't one of the things that we've learned now, though, is that congestion isn't relieved by building more roads? In fact, that generates. We now know this is a common factor. It has its own word. I think a traffic generation or something like that, where roads beget traffic. So haven't we learned now that building more roads won't fix that problem?
Well, that's right, but a lot of the roads that are being built now, as we speak, are trying to approach it a different way. Up toward Washington, D.C., for example, these are roads that you pay to use to get off the roads that are congested, these are revenue-producing roads. The question is, who are they generating the revenue for? A lot of these roads are what are called public-private partnerships, some private investment organization. It could be individuals, could be a big fund, it could be a union, builds the road, basically, and gets the revenue from it. What benefit the government agency that might control that area gets is somewhat subject to debate.
Well, to say nothing of the two publics that you create, the public that can afford the toll and the other public that has to stay in the congested highway and endure all of the costs, that's a second-class public citizen then.
Well, that's right. But if done right, those who are paying for the high-speed lanes could free up the regular lanes and everybody could travel. It could be a win-win situation for the traveler. That remains to be seen because this is just something that is really under development.
You know, it's great. You've got a lot of wonderful examples in this book. It's called The Road Taken, and Henry Petrosky is the author. And, you know, one of the examples, I think, in a way to shed light on how ideas come to light was the idea of the street light was actually started by police officers, right?
Well, that's right. Back in the early 20th century, when the automobile was coming into its into a large growth period, traffic was becoming a really difficult question, controlling the traffic. It's not that this was a new question, because horses and wagons had to be controlled too, but they traveled at a slow pace, and there was generally it was a forgivable pace. But with automobiles, they tended to travel more quickly, and they could do more damage. At intersections in urban areas, the way to control the traffic was with a policeman, basically putting his hand up to halt traffic, and that evolved into having a sign that he could turn to stop or go. And then eventually the policeman got the idea to put a light up that would be red for stop and green for go. And this was quite an advance, but it still required a policeman to stand beside the light or near the light to flip the switch to go red or green. So it still was very manpower intensive. In New York and other big cities, the big movement, the big advance was to put traffic lights in towers, literally towers that were set up in the middle of intersections. This provided more visibility. It also protected the policeman, because the policeman could sit up in sort of a crow's nest. And also it enabled the policeman at one intersection to see down the road some distance to another intersection, and there could be some coordination. In the 1920s, the late 20s, in New York, for example, they introduced traffic lights that would be automatically changed. They would be connected, you know, with through electrical signals,
yeah.
And you didn't need a policeman to attend them. That saved an enormous amount of money, I mean, literally millions of dollars back then. And also it saved a lot of manpower, which freed up the police to do something else. But there was a lot of confusion at the beginning. It was not obvious how you should regulate the lights. Should they all turn green along an avenue at once? Should they all turn red at once? Or should they be staggered as you're driving down the avenue? Should you hit green, 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 green if you go at the right space, right speed? And it took a while to figure that out. It also took a while for the public to catch on and behave, let's say.
I'm talking to Henry Petrosky today on The State of Things. His book is called The Road Taken, The History and Future of America's Infrastructure. Yeah, I would think initially there'd be some fear that if without a policeman standing around, folks are just going to ignore that red light.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what happened. So there was a belief that, well, you have a traffic light, but you've got to have a policeman standing next to it. Even though he was not controlling it, you know, he was the enforcer.
Well, the story of the stop sign is also kind of interesting to me. The idea that it's an octagon, I mean, that's a stop sign, but that was somewhat of a debate or something of a debate.
At first, all traffic signs were more or less rectangular, square or rectangular. This seems natural. That's what signs are. Mm-hmm. But when the lighting was not good, when conditions were not, visibility conditions were not, you know, optimal, it was hard to read these signs. But changing their shape and making the stop sign into an octagon made it clear what it was, whether it was daylight or nighttime. As long as you could see its silhouette, you could tell that it was a stop sign. The yield sign we have now, you know, is a triangle, and we all recognize that, and nothing else is that shape. So that helps a lot.
I wonder about the will to change all of this. You know, there used to be, when it came to infrastructure, this was the one thing every politician could agree on. You know, we could spend money on this because it was a way to give out jobs, it was a way to keep people working, and it was a way to create public infrastructure. But more than that, I mean, if you're a politician, you want to be able to give something away. What happened to that? In the good old days, Republicans and Democrats both wanted to have some money to give away in public works projects.
Well, that's right, but there was also a lot of graft, to be honest about it, and that was another reason the politicians wanted it. Today, one of the problems is the politicians don't want to raise the gas tax. They stay away from that who knows what. So we need more money to do what we'd like to with the infrastructure, but we can't because we simply don't have the money. And to make up the difference, the federal government has, over the past several decades, been contributing to the Highway Trust Fund to make the revenue match the expenditures, but that just can't go on because there are so many other demands on the federal budget.
Henry Petrosky, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Henry Petrosky is the author of the book, The Road Taken, The History and Future of America's Infrastructure. He reads tomorrow at 7 o'clock, the Regulator Bookshop in Durham. You can find out more about the book at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and Charlie Shelton Ormond. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.